This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Even before the coroner's report comes out, suspicions mount that Michael Jackson died from an overdose of prescription drugs, as did the actor Heath Ledger and Anna Nicole Smith, and, as in her case, authorities question the role of personal physicians. Now, these are obviously high-profile cases, and few of us hire a doctor for whom we are the only patient. But the availability of prescription drugs is a big issue, and it operates on at least two levels. One, the belief that between the sprained ankle, the root canal, and the back spasms, there are way too many pills available, and it's way too easy for us and our kids to abuse them. The other, the perception that people with chronic pain suffer because doctors under-medicate. Today we hear from physicians and nurses about the push-pull between patients, the law, and medication. But wait, there's more. Later in the program, what did you buy from a TV pitchman? Send your infomercial confessions to talk@npr.org. But first, if you're a doctor or a nurse, what are the pressures you face from patients? Are you hesitant to prescribe pain medication? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with Dr. Paul Christo. He directs the Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and he joins us from his office in Baltimore. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I wonder, what kind of pressure do you face from patients who think they need pain relief?
Well, you know, I think initially it's important to realize that in general, pain is undiagnosed, untreated, and undertreated, and therefore is a significant public health problem. I think that through these discussions, and especially in light of the events that occurred to Michael Jackson, many regulators and perhaps the public don't realize that pain and chronic pain has really reached epidemic proportions. I mean, for example, the prevalence of pain is estimated to be about 100 million people who live with chronic pain. So really, pain at this point is not well treated, and there are really not enough physicians even who are well trained enough to use opioids comfortably to treat those who are in need.
And you're talking about pain management as a specialty. 100 million people, that's an awful lot of people.
Indeed. There are private, for example, internists and family practitioners who are frontline care providers who see a good number of patients who are in pain. And I think that those individuals are unfortunately not adequately trained with respect to the use of multiple different agents that we use to treat pain, and specifically opioids. And unfortunately, many of these providers, primary care providers, for example, are afraid of regulatory scrutiny when it comes to the use of opioids for the treatment of pain.
In other words, they're afraid if they prescribe too much, the cops are going to come down on them.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And yet there is also that other impression that there's enough Vicodin and Darvocet and Percocet in people's medicine cabinets that this is a major problem for today's teenagers who get addicted to it.
Well, and that's a great point because, you know, I think fairly recent studies indicate that the abuse perhaps of prescription drugs is higher than I think almost every other medication, prescribed medication, except marijuana, which is not prescribed. So it is a concern on the part of the federal government and the DEA, and especially given the fact that I think recent evidence indicates that those that are using or misusing perhaps the prescribed medications and specifically opioids are teenagers and young adults.
But there's an awful lot of it out there for them to use.
It sounds like there is quite a bit out there, and you know, this goes back again to the importance of educating physicians who prescribe opioids, and I think we're talking about the short-acting opioids, for example, Vicodin, which is hydrocodone, and Percocet, and so on. In terms of regulating them and ensuring that patients have adequate follow-up, giving them, say, a 30-day supply, monitoring side effects. I mean, that's what we're talking about that's so critical to do to properly treat pain and to help reduce the risk of misuse, abuse, and addiction.
And there is also, describe for us the tension that sometimes arises between patients who think they need it and doctors who are sometimes reluctant to prescribe it.
Well, there is tension that exists there, and given the fact that the public, I think, is more concerned and aware of pain and pain treatment, and realize that pain is important to treat, and at the same time, physicians, especially again, I think primary care physicians, are reluctant and afraid because of certain cases, perhaps like Michael Jackson or Anna Nicole Smith, and a couple other high-profile cases that make everyone sort of gasp and realize, gosh, this is the use of opioids. It may not be particularly indicated and may be a high risk because they can cause death. So there is a tension there. And I think my job, I feel, is to believe patients who have pain, who suffer from pain, and to trial them on, if indicated, certain opioids, and to follow them up regularly and to do certain things to mitigate against the risk of addiction.
Get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We want to hear from doctors and nurses today about the push-pull between patients, the law, and pain medication. And we'll begin in Syracuse, New York. Karan is on the line.
Hi, Neil. I just wanted to make the point that we have more information available to us via the internet than we've ever been able to get about our medications.
Mm-hmm.
I was just prescribed Vicodin. I've been suffering with pain since 1978 from a car accident, serious injuries. I'm facing a bilateral knee replacement, was prescribed Vicodin at a fairly low dose, and I chose, after reviewing the information on the internet, to cut those pills in half because I'm not looking to be pain-free. I'm looking to have it managed. I want to get through the day, but I don't expect to be pain-free.
And is that what the physician told you to do?
No, she said, take these pills, take two of them if you need it. Well, that's great, but I need to do what's comfortable for me. And what's comfortable for me is avoiding addiction, avoiding even the emotional and psychological addiction you can face.
And Dr. Christo, some people do fear becoming addicted.
They do, and the caller brings up an excellent point, because I think there are a good number of patients whom I see who express a concern about addiction, and I think it requires education, and it is a concern. But in reality, if you look at some of the information we have on the risk of addiction, even in the general population, that is those people who are not using opioids, the risk of addiction is maybe about 10%, and it's believed to be about that or maybe even less in the chronic pain population. So I have discussions with patients and acknowledge the fact that addiction is a concern. And in order to reduce this risk, we're going to do things like give you a 30-day supply of a particular opioid and have you sign an opioid agreement and do your random urine drug testing and also do pill counts. And it's really done to be safe and to ensure that patients understand how to take these medications and at the same time communicate with me, like this particular caller, on his or her concerns about addiction.
And I'm sure that some patients would respond to that. What? You don't trust me? Who are you, big brother?
Well, that's great. That's right. I mean, yeah, you're right. But, these are regulated and they're controlled substances. And as a result, and they can cause death. So I think that to have a high degree of structure surrounding their use is important.
And we heard Karan say that she wanted to be monitored anyway. Karan, thank you, and good luck with the surgery.
Oh, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go quickly to, this is Madeline. Madeline calling us from St. Louis.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Basically, I've been dealing with chronic pain for about 18 months now, and I've gone from doctor to doctor, and I think I'm on a good path now, but I encountered problems really just getting education about how to use any of the narcotic medications. So it's really been a cycle of me just learning on my own. And I kind of felt like they were willing to write the prescription, but they didn't want to talk about it.
And did you worry that you were in danger of crossing the line, taking too many?
No, that wasn't my problem was not knowing just when it was appropriate to take them. So actually, I think I went the other direction of not using them enough. And over time, over 18 months, probably about 10 or 12 months into this, into my back problems, I went from one medication to a stronger medication. So when I would go from one doctor to the next doctor, they would kind of look at me in shock, like, what are you taking? How much are you taking? And I felt like it wasn't my fault that I was taking that. I felt like the medical system had kind of pushed me there. And I didn't really even know.
Well, Madeline, I've had back miseries. Please, I understand. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Joining us now is Sandra Johnson. She's Professor Emerita of Law and Healthcare Ethics at St. Louis University Law School. With us today from the studios of KWMU, our member station in St. Louis. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
And we're just hearing so many different reactions to this. There is a perception that personal physicians are freely doling out opioid prescriptions. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't think so. In fact, I think one of the problems with Michael Jackson and Anna Nicole Smith and those kinds of headline cases is we take them to heart and we think they're the truth. But we really need to look at the data, because the reality is that a 2008 study of all studies of chronic pain patients and their potential for addiction showed that the incidence of addiction among chronic pain patients who had no history of substance abuse, your ordinary patient, is 0.19%.
That's
0.19%.
Tiny, obviously.
It's very tiny. And so I think we overreact when we see a celebrity in the headlines who's had problems and think that that's the case for everyone. And then every patient begins to be treated like Michael Jackson, guilty until proven innocent. And then on the public policy side, data is equally important, because I think you and I both have heard all the headlines about the prescription abuse epidemic we're having, especially with teenagers.
Right.
But the National Survey on Drug Use and Health comes out every year. It's a government survey that tests the use of prescription medicines and illicit drugs over time. And it's really quite surprising. They ask about misuse of prescription drugs. And the data has actually been absolutely stable since 2002. No increase. Doesn't look like an epidemic to me. And then furthermore, the question they ask, they measure misuse, not abuse. And the question they ask to prove that there's misuse, is they ask the respondent, have you taken a drug that wasn't prescribed for you? Or that you took only for the experience or feeling it caused. Now, lots of people take drugs that aren't prescribed for them, and pain patients in particular are taking pain medicine because it makes them feel better.
All right. Hang with us. We're going to have to take a short break. We're talking about doctors and nurses and the push-pull between patients, the law, and pain medication. One argument holds that doctors overprescribe, that they're too easy to get and to abuse. On the flip side, the argument that too many people in chronic pain suffer because doctors worry about over-medicating their patients. If you're a doctor or a nurse working with pain management, what are the pressures you feel from patients? Are you hesitant to prescribe pain medication? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Dr. Paul Christo, who works in the pain medicine program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and Sandra Johnson, Professor Emerita of Law and Healthcare Ethics at St. Louis University Law School. And here is an email that we have from Natya, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, properly, who's a nurse. It's especially difficult to treat patients that are frequent flyers who are repeatedly admitted for pain and have a long list of allergies that includes most of the commonly used moderate pain medications. How do you address pain is what the patient says it is. And Dr. Christo, is that an issue?
I mean, it is an issue at times, and if patients have used multiple different types of opioids, then it limits our choices. However, usually some patients have not tried all opioids, and it's important to trial them. And I guess we're talking about perhaps sustained or long-acting opioids versus short-acting, because there's a difference between the two. Vicodin, for example, and Percocet are typically short-acting, and then things like OxyContin and MS-Contin and a diuretic patch and so on are longer acting sustained release preparations. And for the chronic pain population, those are the agents that we typically use, that is the sustained release opioids that have been found to be more useful in controlling pain and thereby improving function.
I see. And Sandra Johnson, as you look at this in terms of an ethical issue, the doctors looking at the problems that they face, patients sometimes saying they're in terrible pain, and then on the other hand, as we've heard mentioned earlier, problems that they worry about the law.
Yeah, I think they have to treat the patient in front of them. And that means to me that they really don't carry into the office with that one patient a mission to save the entire society from addiction and diversion, because this particular patient is a patient in need and may have nothing to do with that other with the other problem. So I think if you focus on the single patient, that's where your duty lies. For doctors, it's really hard. If they're facing significant legal risk and they then have to decide whether to do the right thing by the patient or the right thing by themselves, that's an ethical dilemma. Now, I want to make it clear that most doctors face no legal risk at all. Emergency room physicians, physicians treating patients who are dying, oncology patients, post-surgical, none of that is of any interest to any legal agency whatsoever.
There have been cases, though, where some doctors have been prosecuted.
Yes. I think in the chronic pain area, a physician in an office-based practice in a chronic pain area, that's where the legal interest lies. And in that area, we really have a complete conflict between two legal agencies. State medical boards have adopted guidelines with practice management techniques that honor the need for pain treatment while setting up systems to avoid diversion and addiction. That's the right way to go. That's a medical way to go. In contrast, the Drug Enforcement Administration has followed for the last several years a very aggressive program of prosecuting physicians criminally for their prescription of pain medications. Now, the DEA said clearly in a statement in 2003 that doctors shouldn't be afraid because, after all, only 34 doctors were arrested out of the million that carry a DEA permit. But that's no consolation to the doctor when they see that the consequence of being spotted, being investigated, being arrested, is that they tend to lose their practice, disrupt their patients, lose necessary business relationships. Stakes are just too high.
And briefly, we're going to talk with the DEA representative in just a moment, but do you think there's had been a chilling effect on that basis?
Yes, the DEA put out a document saying there has not been a chilling effect, but I can tell you there has been. And two recent cases in Florida illustrate it, both cases in which the court, the judge said, this was vexatious prosecution of two physicians who did nothing wrong, did not violate the law.
Well, Sandra Johnson, thanks for your time today. We do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Sandra Johnson is a professor emerita of law and healthcare ethics at St. Louis University Law School with us today from KWMU, our member station in St. Louis, Missouri. As promised, let's bring in Mark Caverly into the conversation. He's Supervisory Diversion Investigator with the Drug Enforcement Administration. He's been kind enough to join us today here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Neil.
And is the DEA, as we just heard, aggressively cracking down on doctors?
I just have to answer that a flat no. I think we have to put this in context of what we're seeing around us. And we've alluded to that a little bit earlier in the program about the concern about prescription drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
These are opioids. They're very strong. They have a strong potential for abuse and a strong potential for addiction. Congress placed them in that particular schedule almost 40 years ago. But there's a misperception, I think, that these drugs are safe because they are manufactured under government standards. They're dispensed by your friendly neighborhood pharmacist, prescribed by your trained physician, that these drugs are safe to take and safe to use, and that's just not the case.
Well, is the emphasis of the DEA's enforcement on these pills that are probably too common or may be too common in some parents' medicine cabinets and are abused by teenagers, or as we've been hearing from investigations of people who are prescribed pills for chronic pain?
Yeah. I think if you look at the doctors who have been prosecuted, and I understand that numbers don't comfort people. If you're one of the 35 who's been arrested, or if you're a physician and you hear of the neighbor in the town who's perhaps been arrested for some practices, the numbers are going to offer you little comfort. But I think you have to look at the conduct of those physicians. If you look at the egregiousness of their actions, physicians who prescribe pills in parking lots, who may exchange prescriptions for sex or illegal drugs, this isn't the practice of medicine. I think that most honest people have difficulty perceiving of someone in that position of authority and responsibility, perhaps abusing that position, but unfortunately it does happen.
And yet, on the other side, perhaps occasionally the agency does go too far, the case we just heard about from Sandra Johnson.
Yeah, I'm not aware of the specifics of that case. I don't doubt perhaps that was the judge's quote, but I can't address that specific case. I think at the end of the day, frankly, we all want the same thing. As a regulator, as an enforcer, we're tasked with with the responsibility of seeing that these drugs don't get abused. But on the other hand, to balance the scale, we're also tasked as an agency to ensure that there's a sufficient quantity for legitimate medical use. So at the end of the day, you know, we really want the patients who need the medications to get the drugs they need in the amounts they need, but we also want to prevent those individuals who may be abusing the system or who may be abusing these substances from obtaining those drugs.
Dr. Christo, let me bring you back into the conversation again there at Johns Hopkins. Does the DEA and its practices, do they help or hurt?
Well, I think the practices can do both. I think that the practices are there to ensure that these medications are used safely and appropriately, and that is for medical purposes. At the same time, the practices can create quite a bit of fear on the part of physicians who are really sometimes at a loss of how to prescribe them properly, and as a result, fear that if they prescribe them at all, they may completely lose their license or their career. So I think that it is positive and negative at the same time.
And whether chilling effect was the intent or not, I wonder, Mark Cavalli, do you understand the chilling effect was the effect?
Yeah, I do understand it. I think there's a perception that there's a DEA investigator or an agent behind every rock and beneath every bush, just waiting for a physician to make a mistake. And that's just not the case. I talk to a lot of physician groups, and invariably I get asked the same question, whether in a public setting or they may come up to me later afterwards. And they'll ask me, how much can I prescribe to my patient? And the unasked question is, how much can I prescribe to my patient so that you won't darken my door,
right,
so they don't get into trouble?
How much can I get away with?
Yeah. How much can I get away with? And I try to turn the question around, and I tell the doctor, you know, the question you should be asking is, how much does my patient need? In the federal regulations, there's a three-part test to look whether a controlled substance prescription is legitimate. The doctor has to be registered. He or she has to have a DEA number and a medical license. But the prescription also has to be issued for a legitimate medical purpose in the usual course of professional practice. And that's it. So while I tell the doctors this, I also give them some advice. And it's like real estate. You know, the most important thing about real estate is location, location, location. Well, the most important thing about a medical practice is document, document, document. You know, we see so many cases where physicians just aren't documenting what they're doing and why they're doing it, and that frequently leads them into trouble.
Oh, they love paperwork. Let me ask you one other question, and then we'll let you go. We're talking about prescription drugs here and doctors. The Internet seems to be willing to provide me with large amounts of Vicodin just with the click of a mouse and no prescription whatsoever. What are you doing about that?
Well, the Ryan Haidt Act was passed by Congress just recently and implemented that engages a number of safeguards in regards to Internet pharmacies, and it's a whole topic in and of itself. But those regulations have just recently been implemented back in April. We're beginning to see, I think, some successes in that regard. As with anything else, traffickers are going to respond and look for other
leapfrog means.
Yeah. Squeeze the balloon is the expression that we'll use. You squeeze it in one place and it's going to pop out somewhere else. But Congress was kind enough to pass some very effective legislation, which we've implemented by way of regulation, and we're starting to see some effects.
Mark Cavalli, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it. Mark Cavalli is Supervisory Diversion Investigator for the Drug Enforcement Administration, Chief of the Liaison and Policy Section of the Office of Diversion Control, and was kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. Still with us, Dr. Paul Christo, Director of Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Program Development Department at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Here's an email question from Leonie in Boston. I just graduated from an internal medicine residency in Boston. My concern with prescribing narcotics for chronic pain is the lack of evidence for long-term efficacy and improvement in functional status. Can your speaker comment on that?
Well, there is somewhat of a lack of information with respect to long-term efficacy. I'm not sure what the writer or the caller means by long-term. Is that 2 years? Is that 3 years? Is that 10 years? But I think that that has been a concern with the use of opioids for example, low back pain. But remember, the opioids are the gold standard for the treatment of pain after surgery and for cancer pain, for example. It's really the use of opioids for the population of people who suffer from chronic pain that's not malignant, for example, that therein lies the difficulty.
Right. It's definitional difficulties.
Yeah, that's right.
And finding accurate ways to measure it, which don't exist. Stay with us, if you will. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Ralph on the line. Ralph calling from San Antonio.
Hey, sir. I'm listening to your show. First off, I mean no disrespect, but I hear the doctor speaking, and he's a pain management doctor. I hurt myself on the job 7 years ago. I've had four lower back surgeries, and they're all basically they came out to be failed back syndrome. I've been on opioids for about 7 years, 6 years. I resent the fact that this doctor wants a 51-year-old person such as myself to be subjected to something that's a little bit less than babysitting, where I'm going to have someone count my pills and hold my hand and drive 40 miles in one direction every 30 days to get medication that I must have. Otherwise, I cannot sleep, I cannot move, I cannot do a thing. As far as the DEA person that was on the line, I believe, I don't know how to say it nicely, but he's a liar. I have been to pain management doctors and jokingly ask him if the DEA has been there yet, and the doctor would tell me straight up, yeah, they've already been here. So these DEA guys are going around to these doctors' offices, and they are intimidating them, and they're keeping them from writing prescriptions. Now, I've got a messed up back that will
never. Did you ever consider, just for a moment, Ralph, it might be your doctor who's telling you something that might not be entirely accurate?
I'm sorry?
That your doctor might be saying that to get you off his back?
I've had like five different pain management doctors, and they pretty much are on the same sheet of music as far as the amount of medication. They are so afraid of being arrested or losing their license that they don't want to give opioids to people who really need them, like myself.
All right, let's talk with Dr. Paul Christo and let him respond to what you had to say on the other point.
Well, I think the caller makes a good point about the importance of using opioids for the treatment of chronic pain and how their use can improve function, because that's in essence what we're looking for when we prescribe these agents. With respect to his resentment, I'm sensitized to that, and I can understand that frustration. At the same time, because these are regulated substances, they're controlled substances, it's important to have, I believe, quite a bit of structure surrounding their use. And for me, as a pain physician, I think it's important to do pill counts and to do your random urine drug testing, and then also to have patients sign an opioid agreement that it basically enables them to understand what this treatment is all about, you know, and that there are certain side effects associated with treatment, and as well as concepts surrounding the use of them, which we haven't discussed as much at this show. But, for example, tolerance, physical dependence, and addiction are different concepts and I think are confused when patients begin these therapies.
Ralph?
Well, that's all fine and well, but when you're in a situation like mine where I basically have to have this medicine on a daily basis in order to just live a normal life, this gentleman talks about this pain management agreement like it's nothing. It's like an 8-page document. It's not just one page, yes, I will, no, I won't. It's an 8-page document, basically all kinds of information. I know plenty about the effects of drug abuse and addiction. I know all about that. The doctor that I'm seeing right now says that I should be taking 12 to 15 Norcos a day. 12 to 15 a day. There's nowhere near that I get that much, but that's the level of pain that I'm in. I'm supposed to be getting a fifth back surgery to repair previous surgeries that went belly up on me. And again, you're talking, I've been through the morphine thing, I've been through the OxyContin thing, I've been through all of them. I've tried many of them.
Ralph,
go ahead, sir.
I'm afraid we're just running out of time, and I think we hear you, and I wish you best of luck with that next surgery. I hope it solves the problems.
I'm not looking forward to it. Thanks.
Nobody looks forward to surgery. Appreciate that. And Dr. Christo, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Paul Christo specializes in pain medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, with us today from his office in Baltimore.